Today's Taisho will be on Case 8 in the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 8 is entitled Suigan's Eyebrows. Engo's Introduction. An enlightened person enjoys perfect freedom in active life. He is like a dragon supported by deep waters, or a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. The man who is not awakened drifts about in the affairs of the world. He is like a ram that gets its horns caught in a fence, or like a man who waits for a rabbit to run against a tree stump and stun itself. The enlightened person's words are sometimes like a lion crouched to spring, sometimes like the Diamond King's treasure sword. Sometimes their effect is to shut the mouths of the world-famed ones. Sometimes it is as if they simply follow the waves, coming one after another. When the enlightened person meets others who are enlightened, then friend meets friend. He values them, and they encourage each other. When he meets those who are adrift in the world, then teacher meets student. His way of dealing with such people is far-sighted. He stands firm before them like a thousand-fathom cliff. Therefore, it is said that the way of the Absolute is manifest everywhere. It has no fixed rules and regulations. The teacher sometimes makes a blade of grass stand for the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, and sometimes makes the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, stand for a blade of grass. Tell me, on what principle is all this based? Do you understand? See the following. Main subject. Suigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and said, "During the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, has Suigan any eyebrows?" Hofuku said, "He commits theft. He who commits theft has a guilty conscience." Choke said, "They've grown." Umon said, "Kan." Secho's verse, Suigan's words, unanswerable in thousands of years. Umon's Kan, losing his money and committing a crime. Senile Hofuku. Was he nimble or did he mumble? Long-tongued Suigan, definitely a thief. Flawless is the jewel. Who can appreciate the priceless? Choke knew well, he said, "They've grown." Thank you so much for coming to practice on this beautiful summer day. It's like the perfect summer day. And I'm so glad we were able to get off of the cushion and go outside. That's not always possible, but really beautiful Kinhin today. And then I'm very glad we were able to come back into the room and recite the sutras together. You know, for about the first 20 years of my practice, and I've been practicing for 40 years, for about the first 20 years of my practice, I didn't really understand why we chanted sutras. It was something that we did at the Seattle Zen Center, and I continued to do it here in New Jersey. But then one day I was reading about the early Sangha, the Buddhist early community in India. And it turns out that originally Buddhist monks and nuns and lay people didn't chant sutras. But Buddha's contemporaries was the founder of the Jains, the Jain religion. And apparently, early in the history of the Jains, they were torn apart by sectarian differences. So when they would have a gathering, people would start arguing immediately about points of doctrine. And they would say hurtful things to each other, and factions would form. And if somebody was criticized, he would dig in his heels and turn the cannons back on the other person, and so on. And the Buddha apparently heard about this, or even saw it. And he came up with the idea of chanting the sutras together. And so Buddhists began to chant the sutras together, and that and the Buddha's instruction not to argue with people about points of doctrine made the Sangha a very healthy place to be. You know, when we do something together, something like chanting, we really are harmonizing ourselves, harmonizing one another, with one another. You know, this is something that Western people have a little trouble with, because, you know, Western people, a little bit like the Jains in ancient India, we believe that, you know, harmony is achieved by having what we call like a meeting of the minds. So we believe that in order to have harmony, we have to believe the same thing. And so, you know, if you're talking to somebody, what you want to do is have a dialogue with them until you can have a meeting of the minds, until you both go, oh, yes, we agree with each other. And now that's harmony. And there's something to recommend itself about that idea, right? That you think your way into common ideas, and when you have common ideas, you have common ground, you know. But actually, I know people who have common ideas who don't get along at all. You know, in my department, we have a very large number of Marxists. And I myself go to their meetings sometimes because I agree with many of the things they say. You know, they are Marxists who have studied Marxist works, and they have studied with very famous Marxist professors. And by the way, Marxism is ridiculed in the United States, but you know, it's an international movement, and they're really deep thinkers all over the world, in India, in China, in many countries of Europe, in South America, who consider themselves followers of Marx. And the interesting thing is, all of these people are deeply committed to Marx. They deeply accept Marx's ideas. And when you go to the meeting, it's a miracle they don't throw chairs at each other, because they don't agree about anything, even though they agree about everything. You know, it turns into an argument every time I've gone. It's like, wow, that's amazing, you know. So sometimes having common ideas doesn't achieve harmony. These people all have pretty common ideas. I mean, ideas can never be so identical, right? I mean, even if we both believe in Marx, and even if we both pick the same passage in Marx's Capital, you know, we might not interpret it exactly the same way, and even if we do, we might change our minds, you know. So there's another way to achieve harmony. You know, this was actually understood by the Buddha, and also by the ancient Chinese. You know, in the West, we tend to look, we think that people reach agreement by finding the same ideas, but ancient Chinese people realize that ritual is really harmonizing. So doing a ritual together creates harmony. Everybody's contributing their actions together in a synchronized way. And rituals and rites actually produce a very harmonious spirit in a way that just agreeing about ideas might not. If we can do something together, it actually creates a kind of harmonious spirit, whether we believe the same thing or not. You know, so actually Confucius was one of the people who made this discovery, that doing rituals together was harmonizing and created deep bonds among people. This idea, I think, is very profound. You know, in Tibetan tradition, there are quite a few rituals that we in Zen don't really have. We don't have very many rituals, but one of the most important rituals we have is chanting together. And it's far from trivial. You know, when we chant together, we're harmonizing our voices. You know, people have done studies, you know, when you chant together, your brainwaves start synchronizing with each other. This is really true. I'm not making it up. It's that people have done studies about this. Do you know that when you sit down with somebody and you just eat with them and you start exchanging information or you just have a casual conversation, your brains start firing in the same patterns. And when people do things together, that's even more so. So, one of the reasons people all over the world make music and dance, this is like a common human event everywhere in the world, they synchronize their actions. And this creates this very powerful harmony and deep bonds of affection and connection. Reciting the sutras is quite profound, is a quite profound practice. You'll notice that many of the sutras are not translated. In fact, hardly any of them are translated. Those of you who have been in our Sangha, in our community for a long time, know the story about the sutras, but many people who are newer might not know that, the sutras are, that we recite are Japanese phonetic versions of Chinese phonetic versions of Sanskrit. So basically, when the Chinese created sutras for recitation, they listened to Sanskrit and tried to plug in phonetic units that sounded like Sanskrit. And then when Buddhism went from China to Japan, the Japanese did exactly the same thing. They turned the Chinese phonetic units into Japanese phonetic units, which don't sound at all the same. And so if Japanese people came into our room and recited the sutras, they would understand no more of it than you do. And probably less if they don't do zazen. So you could say, well, what's the point of this? In fact, I've had people come here and actually criticize and said, why are we reciting these sutras in these, in these dead languages? We should translate them into English so everybody understands. But that person doesn't understand. It's not agreeing about the ideas that really creates the harmony. It's acting together in a synchronizing way that creates these deep bonds of harmony. Content is not so important. In the West, we put a big emphasis on ideas. But people in ancient India and ancient China understood that actually practice is much deeper than ideas. There's actually, scholars actually have terms for this, of course, because they're scholars. But believing the same ideas is called orthodoxy, right? But doing things together is called orthopraxy, like practicing together. And a key element of Zen practice is orthopraxy. My second teacher, Webb, went into a Zen temple with a Western scholar, and the Western scholar came away very disappointed in the Zen monks. So they would do all of these different rituals during the day, and he would say, "Why are you doing that?" And they'd just say, "I don't know," that they do it, and they go on with their rituals. They have images all over the temple. So in many Buddhist temples, there are swastikas. Not the ones that Hitler had. These are quite a bit older than Hitler. They're ancient symbols from India. And he asked him, "What are these symbolized?" "I don't know." And then there's another common sort of like design in Japanese Zen temples. It's a square, a triangle, and a circle all together. "What do these mean?" "I don't know." So, the scholar came away thinking these guys are a bunch of idiots, see. But actually being able to explain what they're doing wouldn't really be that important. The the transformative effect comes from doing it together. So please think about reciting the sutras as a form of deep meditation practice. What we're doing when we recite sutras is we're harmonizing our actions, we're creating a community, but also we're synchronizing our brain functions, believe it or not. And also we're breathing in the proper way. You know, when you recite the sutras, you should try to use your hara, your dantian, to squeeze the breath out until all the breath is gone. So when you're doing a line of sutra, you want to squeeze the breath out by contracting the muscles in your abdomen, and you want to go as far along the line as you can go until you're out of breath, and then you grab some more breath, and then you go another line, see? So as you're doing this, you're dropping into deep, you will begin to drop into deep samadhi. When I first started doing Zen, I thought, why are we wasting our time with these sutras? You know, why don't we get right to the cushion and start meditating? I didn't understand that this was a very deep form of meditation. And the people who created the rhythms that go with our sutras actually have given a lot of thought to changing the tempos. So you'll notice that one sutra has a certain rhythm, a certain tempo, another has a slower tempo, another has a very fast tempo. All of this is by design. This is like meant to have a cognitive and physical effect on you. And creating that deep, we start the day by reciting sutras together. We harmonize ourselves with each other. This is a deep practice. As I say, this is something like this is found all over the world. It's the idea of a ritual, doing something together, orthopraxy. So this has a lot to do, believe it or not, with the koan. Let me get back to the koan before our time is up. Suigan was a Zen teacher, a very highly regarded Zen teacher. And in Zen tradition, they have what are called angos. Those are like periods of practice. So in Zen tradition, at least in Japan, there was there's a summer ango, A-N-G-O, and a winter ango. And the period of practice is announced with a ritual, and it ends with a ritual. And during these many months of the ango, people meditate a certain amount each day, and then they have a sesshin, sometimes once a month. This is how it works. And it's the end of the summer ango. Suigan, at the end of the summer ango, and said to the assembly, spoke to the assembly, and he said, during the summer ango session, I have talked to you a great deal. I've given teisho every day. Now look, do I have any eyebrows left? Now, in addition to his students, there were several of his Dharma brothers who were also deeply awakened Zen practitioners. One of them was named Hofuku. And when Suigan says, do I have any eyebrows? Hofuku said, well, he who commits a theft has a guilty conscience. Why are you asking? Choke, another Dharma brother, says, they've grown. And Umon, Yunmen, Cloud Gate, says, Khan. Okay. So I should tell you that in Buddhist folk beliefs, there's a belief that if a Zen teacher gives a false teaching, if a Zen teacher says something to discourage a student, which is actually considered one of the worst things you can do, believe it or not, in the world of Buddhism, discouraging somebody from practicing or encouraging them not to practice is considered like a very serious offense. very serious breach of ethics. You know, the idea is that everybody is going to wake up sooner or later. And, you know, it happens to people at some point in their lives, and if not in this life, in maybe some other life. But what happens to people who begin to practice Zen is one day they get up and they just feel the desire that something is missing in their life. And they want to wake up. They don't know what waking up is, but they know they're not awake. And this happens all the time. This happened to me when I was about 19 years old or 20 years old. You know, I just realized something is really missing in my life. I read a book on Zen, and I just thought, oh, this is what I'm looking for. You know, this is like the map to where I want to go. It was so compelling to me. And then I was lucky to meet Genki Roshi. But I think people wake up one day and they just say, this way of life that I have is not working for me. There's something inside me which is not being sustained and nourished by the way I live. I don't know what it is, but I know it's not receiving the nourishment it needs. And then people go look for a Zen center or a Tibetan center, and they start to practice. So discouraging people from practicing is a grave offense. You know, if somebody has that energy and you squat, you quash it, you know, that's considered like really bad, you know. I had a graduate director when I was in graduate school who found out, he said, well, listen, why don't you come over? We're having a get-together at my house and we're going to discuss W.B. William Butler Yeats's poetry. And I said, oh, I've got a commitment. And he said, what's the commitment? And I said, I'm in Zen training with Genki Roshi. He said, what? Oh, he was so upset. You know, he said, you're wasting your life. See, fortunately, he didn't know what he was doing was very bad, you know, in Buddhist terms. And I'm so glad I didn't listen to him, you know, because I got my PhD and I also kept practicing. But discouraging people from practicing is a great offense. And also, basically telling people things that aren't true. So if a teacher says something to the students that is not really good for them or is not really authentic Dharma teaching, his eyebrows are supposed to fall off, see? So it's like magical thinking. If you say, you know, Buddha says it's okay to have a drink. Buddha says it's okay to, you know, whatever, push people down in the street. Your eyebrows are going to fall off, right? So that's the legend. And Suigan, at the end of the teaching ango, at the end of the session, stands before his monks and he says, I've been talking and talking. Have my eyebrows fallen out yet? And so he's really asking them for... It seems that he's asking them for their approval. See, their approval. And that's an odd thing for a Zen teacher to do, right? I mean, one of the beautiful things about reciting sutras, just to get back to reciting sutras, is that when there are 24 people in the room, if you recite the sutras, you know, nobody knows it's you making that mistake, you know? So, you know, I myself make mistakes when I recite the sutras, and I sit next to Sandy. And Sandy is impeccable when she recites the sutras. Sometimes I forget to bring... I have a pair of glasses that have bifocals. They have hidden bifocals, and I forget to bring them, and it's hard for me to read the sutras. So sometimes when I'm reciting the sutras, I lose track. And then I just go, nom, 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 you know, until I can find my place. You know, nom, 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 knock, knock, ooh, something, you know. I have them memorized, but if I lose my place, I don't know where to start, you know. So I'm so fortunate to sit next to Sandy. She can cover for me. And, and you have 20-some people all reciting the sutras, you see. We can all sort of take it easy. We don't have to worry so much. You know, in my training once at our Zen center in Seattle, I had to recite, we actually would read at every sesshin, we would read the Diamond Sutra in English. And at some sesshin, you would be picked to read like a quarter of the Diamond Sutra one day, and then somebody else would read a quarter of the Diamond Sutra and a quarter of the Diamond Sutra and a quarter of the Diamond Sutra. And, you know, I remember Genki Roshi calling me into Dogasan and saying, listen, I want you to read a quarter of the Diamond Sutra. You're an English teacher. This should be easy for you. So we had our own translation of the Diamond Sutra, and I had my section. And believe it or not, it absolutely made me terrified. You know, I read things aloud in class, but, you know, we had quite a big community, and I had to read this aloud, and I, you know, if you've been doing Zazen really diligently for a number of days, and it's early in the morning, and you're not feeling 100%, you know, on top of your reading skills, reading that aloud really bothered me, right? And I practiced. Every time we would stop sitting and I would go back to my room, I would practice and just sort of quietly read this aloud. And when I you know, it was my turn to deliver my section of the sutra, the woman who read before me was beautiful. She did an incredible job. Her voice was, her tone, you know, she had a nice voice, beautiful voice. And it seemed to be impeccable, right? As I listened to that, I kept thinking, oh, crap, you know, that is so good. She didn't make a single mistake. And I was happy for her, but I was also really nervous. You know, the pressure was on. And when I read it, you know, actually I did pretty well. You know, you're supposed to read the Buddha's part, and then you're supposed to read Subhuti's part. And, you know, I paused, and I had, you know, and so, world honored one, you know, what it's something. And then, yes, Subhuti, exactly so, right? And then go on, right? But, you know, about halfway through, I started stumbling. And then, you know, the more I stumbled, it's like in athletic competitions, you know, in this slalom, you know, you miss one flag and you start missing them all. You know, I started, and then I was trying to correct myself, and it didn't go very well. I was deeply dejected, you know. The more, you know, it was actually a training opportunity for me, and my teacher knew this, you know. I mean, the more you think about your performance, the worse your performance is likely to get, you know, because you're focusing eventually on yourself and people's perception of you, and not on the sutra, right? And this is so human. We all do this. But, you know, I was really very concerned to do a good job. I wanted people to say, you know, you really read the sutras beautifully, Kurt. You know, I knew you would, you know. And instead, you know, I felt like everybody was looking at me like, oh, man, did he ever botch that up, right? I don't think anybody was really looking at me that way, because eventually we all had to read the sutras. And people knew I was, you know, literate. I actually read books and things. You know, I could speak. But I was overcome by self-consciousness and anxiety, right? And later I had a chance to do it again, and I did a much better job, really, because I just sort of, you know, this is the inner practice of doing anything, right? You know, at first, if somebody just said to you, would you read this, and you read it aloud, it would probably be pretty good. Because you're not self-conscious, you don't know what to expect. But because we had this ritual of reading aloud, and because my friends had done such a good job, you know, especially my friend Elaine, she read it so beautifully, you know, that, you know, I just felt on the spot to to reach her mark. And when I began to stumble, I got more and more embarrassed, you know. And this is a common problem. I've seen students do this too. You know, a few years ago, I was team teaching with a historian. It was a course on the city in the modern world. And my job was to help the students write their papers. And this one student, wrote a fantastic paper. And when we would have conversations, you know, I could hardly get a word in edgewise. But when he had to stand up in front of the room and speak, I sympathized with him because I've been there myself, you know. He started to deliver his paper, and as he did, his speech became more and more faltering. It was like he started missing his text. And then you could see he was very, you know, had very fair skin. His face got very red, right? He actually had to stop, you know. And my colleague, her name is Marion, she sort of said, look, we've all been there. Take it easy, relax, you know, go ahead and get your breath. He got through it, but I'm sure he went home that night and just thought, oh, man, did I do a terrible job. And I've been there myself, you know, when I first started giving papers at academic conferences, I was had a very hard time. You know, I too would go through just what Peter, that student, went through. You know, I would start reading my paper, and it seemed like just a couple minutes in, I would begin to be gripped by this terrible anxiety. And then it was like every word coming out of my mouth, it was just hard. It was like squeezing it out, and I had this sinking feeling, like, oh my God, you know, any minute now I'm just going to burst into tears and run out of here. It never actually happened. You know, eventually I got better at doing this because I just realized, you know, who cares? You know, who cares? You know, first of all, half the people in the room, I told myself, half the people in the room aren't listening anyway, right? And or they're just listening to find something they can argue with, right, you know, after the talk. So it helped me a lot to think that they didn't really care, you know, that they weren't really paying attention to me anyway. It was very liberating to let go of their opinion of me and just focus on what I had to say. But it was very hard. And you know, if you think about it, a lot of socialization goes into creating that anxiety. You know, we depend. It's natural and healthy to look to other people for approval. As children, we look to our parents for approval, and hopefully, our parents give us their approval. You know, and when we do some, if you set the trash can on fire, you don't get a look of approval, right? And that's how as it should be. But you know, the desire to be approved of and thought well of can become a crippling obstacle in any area of life. And you know, and so part of Zen practice is learning how to stop trying to please others and to lose yourself in what you're doing. Just give yourself over to the process. You know, this I speak a lot in talking about Zen practice about I speak a lot of trusting the process. And if you trust the process, you forget about yourself, and you're allowing things to unfold in their own way. My second teacher, Webb, used to just say to me, get out of your way, get out of your own way, get out of your own way, you know. I would say, you know, I can't answer this call, and I'm so stuck. And he would just say, get out of your own way. If you're trying to answer the call, you know, we all have, if you've been practicing Zen for 10 or 15 years, you know, you know, as I had by then, you know, 10 years anyway, you know, I wanted to have the teacher give me a koan, and I wanted to go into the Dokusan room and have the teacher go, oh, that's a wonderful answer. You know, but I would be stuck. And then I would feel defeated, and, you know, I wanted to have a Webb Roshi's approval. And he would just say, get out of the way. And, you know, basically, if you want to never answer your koan, you know, focus on your own performance. Focus on yourself and how people think of you, right? But if you want to answer your koan, just give it up and just focus on the process. Just give yourself over to the process. You know, when I've talked about this many times, but you know, Zen practice was is the thing I love the most about being alive. I've been doing Zen for 40 years, and I hope I live another 40 years so I can keep doing Zen. I get up in the morning and I look forward to it every day. But it was not easy for me. It was physically very difficult to do Zazen. And it was psychologically very difficult. You know, because, you know, I was the sort of student in class who was always wanted to be the best student in the class. So when I was in high school, you know, regardless of the subject, you know, the teacher would ask a question and my hand was always the first up. And now I'm a teacher, you know, and I actually have a hard time with those students because I'm trying to get other people to talk, you know, and there'll be like one or two students and I'll ask a question and, you know, people are still mulling it over and there's a hand already up. Yes, Bill. You know, and it's like, oh, yes, yes, you figured it all out. Great. You know, I don't say that. I say, that's great, Bill. Any other ideas, you know, or something? You know, it's just like, would you put your damn hand down and let somebody else speak, you know? But I was on the other side. It was like, look, look, I've got the answer. I've got the answer. I've got the answer. So, you know, I was so hungry for approval. I wanted, you know, that ratification, which is normal and healthy to a point. But at what point does it cease to be healthy? When you're not living your own life, it ceases to be healthy when you're not living your own life and when you're living your life as you imagine somebody else wants you to live it. Then it becomes very unhealthy. It becomes unhealthy when you can't be spontaneous, when you can't engage with things in a spontaneous and non-judgmental way, especially not judging your own self, right? So yes, it's natural and normal to want to be approved of by others, but on the other hand, it becomes crippling self-consciousness where we can't let go of the self and trust the process. See, so you know, a lot of Zen practice for me was physically challenging, but the most challenging thing was trusting the process. And when I look back on my first years of Zen training, I always think of them as really, really like very difficult psychologically, because I was the kid who always had his hand up, and when I began to work with Genki Roshi and do koans, I was never the kid who had the right answer, and it was, I'm not exaggerating, we would go to a sesshin, and I would be working on the breath. The Roshi said, "Watch your breath," and my reaction was, "Well, why should I watch the breath? You know, this is just for." This is for beginners, you know. I want something more advanced, you know. I was in it, you know. Calculus 2 in high school. You know, why are you giving me the breath? You know, and so you know, and I would go in. I'd say the breath goes in, the breath goes out. What you know, blah blah blah. You know, and Roshi would just ring the bell. Your time is up. You know, and then I tried to be creative. I came, you know, I wrote little poems that I would recite. I brought him a flower, I brought him a rock, you know, ding, 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 you know, sending me out of the room. And meanwhile, everybody else would be answering their koan, you know. I would go in to see Genki Roshi. I would get in, I would just open my mouth and it was over, right? And I spent more time getting into the Dokusan room than I spent in the Dokusan room. You know, and then these people would go in and they'd be in there for 20 minutes. And, you know, and they would come out and they'd have like a little beatific smile, you know, on their face. It's like, oh, crap, you know. So everybody else was answering their koan but me, you know, and this was so difficult for me psychologically. I had no way of trusting the process, you know. The best thing that ever happened to me was when I just gave up. You know, Zen helped me so much. It has helped me so much in my life. I can't imagine what my life would be without Zen. And even though I wasn't answering my koans, I was coming to practice almost every time at the Zen Center. And I felt so much better. I mean, my wife said, you know, you seem like almost like a different person. You're so much happier. You know, you don't have the short fuse anymore. You know, you seem so much better. You know, and I knew it too. You know, it made my life so much better. So I had to decide, you know, am I going to let my Zen failures, quote unquote, drive me out of this practice? Or maybe I am going to be the worst Zen student in our Sangha. You know, maybe everybody else will go on and they'll be Zen teachers and I'll still be working on my breath, you know. But is that as terrible fate as I think it is? Or is that okay? I mean, if your life is working out, you know, that sounds like a good thing, right? You know, there was a very wonderful Zen teacher named Charlotte Joko Beck. And she had a number of students who had trained with her for like 20 years. And she talked about one student coming to see her and said, you know, I've been training for 20 years and I haven't had a Daikensho. I haven't had this amazing experience that everybody talks about. And Charlotte Beck said, well, let me ask you about how's it going with your life? And that person said, oh, very well. You know, said, are you happy? Yes, very happy. You know, do you enjoy, you know, what you do? You know, how's your sitting? He said, oh, I love it. You know, it's like, what's the problem, right? I don't see a problem. You're making a problem. You're undermining your own practice, right? So I had to make a decision. You know, this is helping me. It's making me happy. People around me say I'm easier to live with. But I haven't answered my koan. So what am I going to do? And basically I decided, well, I'll just stick with it. Who cares? Who cares what people think about me? You know, I'm not in it for their approval. I'm in it because it makes my life better, right? I'm going to trust the process. And then what happened after that was, you know, I actually officially never was passed on the breath koan. What happened was, Genki Roshi asked me to be, in our tradition here, in our community, you know, we have people who are appointed to be cooks, and then we have a number of people who are like the, you know, we're lucky enough to have people who love to cook, like Imtiaz. And when Imtiaz comes to Sesshin, he just does this amazing, magical job, and we have like a whole book of his recipes, so that when he's not there, we just do what Imtiaz does, you know. And so our food is at a very high standard. In our community in Seattle, we didn't do that. People were appointed to be Tenzo for 6 months. So they would do two sesshins. At that time, we did four sesshins. See, you'd be responsible for giving up your own practice for half a year in order to take care of the needs of your fellow practitioners at sesshin. And being Tenzo was pretty much a full-time job. You know, you could come in, you could do some sitting in the middle of the day. You could come in and hear the Teisho, but pretty much you were in the kitchen all the time. And so Genki Roshi asked me to be the Tenzo, T-E-N-Z-O, Tienzo. The Tenzo was not a job I wanted. I still had a lot of competitiveness and so on. And when he said I'd like you to be a Tenzo, it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, I want to be your top student. I don't want to be the cook. You know. So I said, yes, of course I'll do that, but only, you know, secretly. I was very reluctant to do it. I've worked in restaurants, and I'm actually quite a good cook myself. I'm not Imtiaz's caliber, but I'm a pretty good cook. So I decided to take this seriously, just because I had this cook's training and I could do it. And you know, when the sesshin started, I have to say, I did an amazing job. I got into it, knowing it wouldn't help me with my Zen practice. it wouldn't resolve my inability to answer my koan. I was just cooking to cook. But I also like to cook. You know, I also actually love to cook. And I enjoy seeing people have a positive experience with the food I make. You know, so I really threw myself into this. You know, one night I even made a béarnaise sauce, believe it or not, a vegetarian béarnaise sauce, which is possible. I peeked through the door. We had unlike the door in our kitchen in Murray Grove, the kitchen door on this one, this kitchen had a plastic window. And everybody would be eating, and I'd look out the window, and I'd see them, and I would, you know, they were really eating, you know, like this was good food. And I even made like bread and snacks for at the end of the day, people could have some bread and some snacks, you know, that I made. Anyway, I got into making this food, this delicious food for people, and their happiness was my happiness. Their success was my success. You know, I was taking care of my brothers and my sisters. And I didn't expect any to get anything out of it. The pure pleasure of taking care of other people is enlightenment itself. And so, you know, at the end of the sesshin, Genki Roshi called me in, and he said, you know, you have done an amazing job as Tenzo. And he said, I'm going to pass you on the breath koan, even though you haven't really passed it. I'm going to let you go on to Mu. He said, but I want you to know this is the first time I've ever seen you do something for others. You know, and he didn't mean that as a criticism. He should have said to me, how did it feel? Because I had to tell you, it felt wonderful. It felt wonderful. You know, it's so wonderful to cook for other people, see the smile on their face. You know, if you ask the people in my Zen community, most of whom are still around, many of them are in Seattle, and you said, do you remember that cooking that Kurt did at that session? They will not remember. You know, in fact, if you go to, what is now Choboji, the Zen Center turned into, it's now called Choboji. And you say, do you remember Kurt Spelmer? Hardly anybody knows my name. You know, the Roshi there, Genjo, is an old friend, but no, they don't know my name. You know, nobody's going to remember that. And yet, I would say it's one of the most important things that ever happened to me in my life. You know, I learned what it feels like to be, you know, to make a gift of your time and your energy and your love to other people. And I lost my self-consciousness in the process, right? And it's we all have a self. You know, there's no, you know, even the Buddha, you know, there's no moment in the sutras where somebody asks the Buddha a question and he goes, huh? Oh, you mean me? I was so outside of myself, I didn't even know you were talking to me, right? Even the Buddha knew he was the Buddha. You know, all people understand they have a self. But the question is, who's running the show for you? You know, is it yourself, your neurotically hungry self, or are you able to put that aside and trust the process and have a bigger life, see? So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we empty our minds, you know, you begin to, and you leave the Saturday sit and you go outside, you know, when you look at the trees or the grass, you're having like this unmediated experience with the trees and the grass. You're not expecting the trees and the grass to be anything but what they are. You're not asking for their approval. When you look at the grass, you're 100% grass. When you look at the trees, you're 100% trees. And usually, when people have that experience, they feel deep gratitude. Deep gratitude. How wonderful to be alive, right? That our self-consciousness gets in the way. You know, if you don't exercise caution, if you don't practice regularly, you know, self-consciousness will cripple your life. It will destroy everything you love. You know, I'm going to stop, but I work with, you know, I I'm an English professor. You know, I know a lot of writers, a lot of professional writers. You know, so many of them are racked by, they're destroyed by, so many artists in general have drinking and substance abuse problems because of their crippling self-consciousness. You know, and they love to write poetry. And when they write poetry, they forget themselves. But, you know, their crippling self-consciousness destroys that love. You know, so there is a way to live beyond that crippling self-consciousness. And we start to do that, but we sit down on the cushion and watch the breath. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things. Main subject, Suigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and he said, "During the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, do I have any eyebrows left?" Hofuku said, "If you're asking, you have a guilty conscience. You know, you're not trusting the process. Who cares what people think? You know, did you throw yourself into your lectures or not?" Choke said, "They've grown." Right? Oman said, "Khan, wonderful.